The headlines. The Israeli military launches fresh deadly strikes on Gaza, where more than 2 million live in the world's biggest open-air prison. Palestine's UN ambassador describes Israel's deadly campaign against Gaza as genocide, saying Israel's measures amount to war crimes. And also, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution hails Palestinians' recent operation against Israel as irreparable defeat for Tel Aviv. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. The Israeli regime continues its indiscriminate aerial strikes on the Gaza Strip for the fifth consecutive day, killing more people in the besieged Palestinian territory. At least 50 Palestinians have lost their lives in fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza, pushing the death toll to 1,050, including scores of children. The attacks left more than 5,100 injured. Israel has pounded Gaza's commercial zones, residential areas, and refugee camps. Over 2 million Palestinians are trapped in the Gaza Strip, which is known as the world's biggest open-air prison. Israel now says it has massed troops and tanks near the Gaza fence and is getting ready for a ground invasion. Israel has used internationally banned white phosphorus bombs in its strikes on Gaza's Karama neighborhood. The regime launched its onslaught on Saturday after Gaza-based resistance groups carried out a multi-front operation in response to Israel's crimes. According to Israeli media, the operation has left 1,200 Israelis dead and nearly 3,000 others injured. The health ministry in Gaza has confirmed the regime's deployment of banned white phosphorus munitions against various areas in the coastal sliver of the Karama neighborhood. A densely populated neighborhood was targeted by the white phosphorus munitions. The use of white phosphorus shells for direct targeting of any positions is illegal under international law, as the practice can amount to war crimes and widespread fatalities as well. However, this is not the first time that Tel Aviv has been accused and on various occasions proven to be using such weapons. Israel has now also said that it has massed troops and tanks near the Gaza fence and is getting ready for a ground invasion. Okay, I'm being told Ashraf Shannon is with us right now. Once again, Ashraf, if you're with us, please bring us up to speed on what's taking place right now. We're covering what's happening in Gaza, the Gaza skyline. Just moments earlier, we saw black plumes of smoke billowing through the air. What's going on right now?
Well, but as you said, the Israeli fighter jets continue to pound the Gaza Strip. Almost everywhere, at least in Gaza City, is being bombed. The Israeli military is concentrating its attacks against Gaza City. Most of the attacks are taking place in Gaza City. Now, there are rumors going on that the Israeli military are using, once again, white phosphorus against the Gaza City today. But the only thing I can confirm is that white phosphorus or white peat shells were used on the first day of on Saturday. That's the only time I know I saw with my own eyes white phosphorus, because it takes forever to distinguish. But I've seen the images earlier, and as I was watching the skies, it looks something similar to white phosphorus. The shape of the shells, that the residue of these shells looks like white phosphorus, but I think it's some kind of poisonous gas or something. That's my own guess, but not white phosphorus. Today it wasn't white phosphorus, because when white phosphorus hits the ground or hits someone's body, it keeps burning forever. As long as it is exposed to oxygen, it will never extinguish. But this happened on the first day of Operation Flood of Al-Aqsa. It took place on near the border east of Al-Shija'iyya neighborhood Saturday afternoon. And this is the things that you're seeing probably in the skies right now. This, while latest numbers from the Ministry of Health show that 1,055 Palestinians were killed so far by the Israeli aggression and attacks against the civilians in the blockaded territory, including scores of women and children. And at least 5,000, more than 5,000 people also were injured. A lot of the injuries are happening, like the child just went through. It seems like he received some injury in the back of his head. He looks not more than 3 or 4 years old, carried probably by his father. And earlier today, the Ministry of Health, or actually the Emergency Medical Service, has held a press conference regarding the problems with the ambulances and the fact that the Israeli regime continues to kill and maim paramedics. I believe at least 7 paramedics have been killed since Saturday as they were heading to pick up the injured or pick up the victims of this Israeli onslaught that's been taking place almost every hour since Saturday. The Israeli regime is not attacking Palestinian resistance fighters. They are attacking Palestinian children, women, and elderly people. This is happening under the watchful eye of the international community. This is taking place while there is also silence from the Arab regimes. This is what people, when you talk to them, they tell you they feel disappointed once again, war after the war, by the silence of Arab regimes. But the spirit of the people in Gaza, their spirits are high. You see someone with a head injury or has a his wounded mother walking by. You ask them what's going on. Tell you, oh, we were bombed. Our neighbors were bombed, and then we were hurt. And immediately, without even them, without me asking him any question, they immediately say, "This is no matter what happens to us, if we die, if we get injured, this is for the sake of Al-Aqsa, for the sake of Al-Quds, for the sake of Palestine." So they are in pain, they are suffering, they are losing their loved ones, but still they are proud of their resistance. They are proud of what Hamas did on Saturday morning by firing thousands of rockets at the Israeli regime and infiltrating the border security fence, fighting with Israeli soldiers face to face, killing Israeli soldiers, capturing Israeli soldiers, taking back with them the bodies of Israeli soldiers who were killed in combat, and also using, it's kind of sarcastic, the resistance fighters, we've seen the videos of them fighting with Israeli soldiers, killing Israeli soldiers, then carrying the bodies of Israeli soldiers and put them in the back of the Israeli military truck that these soldiers were driving, and taking that truck back to Gaza. This is what we saw even on the first day, I believe, in the first day of this fighting on Saturday. Anyone you talk to in Gaza, they tell you it's a historic day. Saturday was a historic day. Saturday, the 7th of October, was a historic day for the Palestinians.
All right. Thank you very much, Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, joining us from Gaza with all the latest updates on the Israeli assault that's taking place on the Gaza Strip. We are going to be hearing from our correspondent throughout the day much more as he'll be giving us updates from the ground. Palestine's ambassador to the United Nations has lashed out at Israel for its deadly campaign against the Gaza Strip and the regime's decision to impose a complete siege on the territory.
Such blatant dehumanization and attempts to bomb people into submission, to use starvation as a method of warfare, and to eradicate their national existence are nothing less than genocidal. These acts constitute war crimes.
Matzer made the comments in a letter to the UN Security Council on Monday. Israel declared its decision to impose a complete siege on Gaza, cutting off the supply of electricity, food, fuel, and water, the move that could leave the territory on the brink of a new humanitarian crisis has drawn international condemnations. The UN said depriving civilians of goods essential for survival is banned under international law. The European Union also criticized Israel's move as a collective punishment against all Palestinians. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution describes as destructive quake the anti-Israel operation launched by Palestinians on Saturday. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said those who attribute the operation to non-Palestinians are making mistakes. The leader underlined that the damage inflicted on Israel in the surprise operation by Palestinians is the result of the regime's own actions. Ayatollah Khamenei said the brave move by Palestinians was a response to years of Israeli crimes. The leader said Israel is now playing the victim card and that Western media outlets are helping the regime in this regard. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the regime cannot be portrayed as an oppressed entity while it is actually a monster. He warned Israel and its backers that the bloodshed of Palestinians will bring them greater calamity. Well, Iraqi resistance groups have warned the United States against any engagement in the ongoing Israeli war on Gaza. Iraq's Hezbollah brigades, also known as Kataib Hezbollah, said that it will hit U.S. bases and Israeli positions if Washington rather gets involved in the Gaza war. The group added that its forces, drones, and missiles are fully prepared to retaliate. The Al-Nujaba movement issued a similar warning. It promised a decisive military response in case the U.S. and any other country gets involved in the conflict against the Palestinian nation. People in different countries have held new rallies in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza and their struggle to free their land. They've chanted slogans in support of the Palestinian cause and denounced the Israeli regime's atrocities. Let's take a listen to those slogans and some of the comments by the protesters.
What is right, what actually the Palestinian people are going through, we know, and we have the heart to accept that and to support that. That's why we all support that, a cause that we stand by.
We've come here to express our feelings to save Gaza. We stand with the Muslims of Gaza, and until they're victorious, we will stand with them.
If Israel had complied with the UN resolutions as it should have done and go without punishment before the international community, then this would not have taken place.
I'm here as a Palestinian to support the people from Mideast, both for the people in Israel and Palestine. We are demonstrating here because there won't be any peace while Israel keeps occupying a land that doesn't correspond to it.
I think what the Palestinian resistance did is totally valid and legitimate. It's their right to respond to the attacks of the Israeli state after more than 75 years against the Palestinian people.
Palestinians must have their rights and lands returned to them. They must be compensated. All those who were killed in the past should be compensated according to Islamic Sharia law. We demand an end to the nighttime attacks on Palestine.
Thousands of UK residents have also taken to the streets to defend Palestinian rights to self-defense. That says the British authorities have sided entirely with Israel, even as bombs rained down on civilian populated areas in besieged Gaza region. Robert Carter was at the London rally and reports on the ground there.
Thousands of people came out in London to support opposing sides amid a flare-up of violence in the occupied Palestine. Israel's embassy became the focus of huge outpouring of support for Palestine. At the same time, a separate pro-Israel vigil was held outside Downing Street. In attendance was the British Prime Minister, who used the occasion to reiterate his staunch support for Israel's regime.
There are not two sides to these events. There is no question of balance. I stand with Israel.
Pro-Palestine protesters used their voice to condemn the occupation, which they say is the bottom line cause for the recent bloodshed.
Many people across the UK are deeply saddened, but also very furious, not just at the images and videos of intense human suffering coming out of occupied Palestine right now, but also at the British authorities themselves. The UK government, for example, is expressing some extreme pro-Israel comments right now, throwing their full support behind the regime, which is currently engaged in bombing raids on Gaza, which is targeting very heavily civilian-populated areas.
Several senior UK government ministers have fully committed their support to Israel. The Prime Minister tweeted on Saturday that he was shocked by this morning's attacks by Hamas terrorists. Israel has an absolute right to defend itself, before adding a tweet showing Israel's flag projected across number 10. The Home Secretary attacked pro-Palestine protesters, tweeting, "There is no place on British streets for demonstrations that glorify terrorism." Others, including the Foreign Secretary, added their support to Israel's right to defend itself, but describing Palestinian fighters as terrorists.
Basically, it was expected, but we didn't think it would be so severe in the sense of so explicitly supporting Israel when Israel is the occupying power. It is violating all the international laws. And the very fact that just a few weeks ago, the British government was telling us that any occupying power must be resisted in the case of Ukraine. And here we have a double standard that we support one occupying power, Israel, against another in Ukraine. We're supporting the occupied people. So they're sending mixed messages.
The Gaza Health Ministry says hundreds of Palestinians, including many women and children, have been killed by Israeli strikes. Hamas said that its operation came in response to Israel's violations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Al-Quds and growing settler violence. Onlookers can do little more than wait and protest as the conflict looks set to escalate even further. Robert Carter, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance Field. This meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. What I would like to say is that the event of the Sacred Defense is a prominent, important period in our country's history. As to what was being defended, the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic, which was the product of defending the Islamic Revolution, and the country's territorial integrity were being defended. These were the three important things that were being defended. The other side had attacked these three things. Of course, the target of the main important part of the front of the enemy, which I will explain later in the second part of my speech, was not the issue of territorial integrity. That was Saddam's goal. Their target was the revolution. They wanted to suppress this unparalleled, great, important revolution that had taken place in Iran thanks to the sacrifices that had been made by the people.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Why do we say it was unparalleled? Because it was a phenomenon that had not taken place before in major revolutions. It was democratic, it was religious, it was authentic, and it was not dependent. It was related to a nation. It was by the people. It was not like coups, revolutions by political parties, or things of that sort. This revolution was able to remove the dependent corrupt system that was ruling the country and establish a new system and a new voice in its place, the Islamic Republic. Republic means democracy. Islamic means religion. Religious democracy was a new term in the world. We have had religious governments throughout history, but there was no talk of democracy in them. We have had democratic governments, real or fictitious, but there was no talk of religion in them. Never before had there been a government or a system in which religion and this world and the hereafter, the people and God were all involved and were the builders of it. But such a thing happened, and they wanted to crush it, overcome it, and eliminate the Islamic Republic.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency, has said the occupying entity enforces an apartheid system against Palestinians. The admission has been made by Tamir Pardo, who was the regime's spy master from 2011 to 2016.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Pardo becomes the latest former senior official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank amounts to apartheid. That's a reference to the system of racial separation in South Africa that ended in 1994. Leading rights groups in Israel and abroad, as well as Palestinians, have accused Israeli occupation of the West Bank of morphing into an apartheid system. A handful of former Israeli leaders and diplomats have warned that Israel risks becoming an apartheid regime, but Pardo's language was even more blunt. Israel has been practicing an apartheid system against Palestinians, though far more brutally, since 1948. This is when, with the support of Western governments, Zionist terrorists claimed Palestine to be their homeland. Israel launched another war in 1967, occupying more Palestinian territory, such as the West Bank, including East al-Quds, that Palestinians want as the capital of their future state. Since then, Israeli apartheid authorities have created a judicial system that allows them to steal more Palestinian homes and land and dispossess them in order to make way for more illegal settlers. Rights groups have pointed to the discriminatory policies within Israel and in occupied East al-Quds, its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been ruled by the Hamas group since 2007, and its occupation of the West Bank.
Because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, just to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern.
Rocket fire from Gaza. Palestinian fighters carrying out an unprecedented offensive with thousands of rockets. Sirens sounding across Israel, including Tel Aviv and Al-Quds. Israel is being attacked ferociously. This was by far the biggest operation by resistance groups against Israel in decades. We decided to put an end to all the crimes of the occupation. Their time for rampaging without being held accountable is over. We announced Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, and we fired in the first strike of 20 minutes more than 5,000 rockets. That was the announcement by the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of the Hamas resistance group. Armed clashes along the separation fence with Israel near the southern town of Khan Yunis were reported to take place. Fighters seen here breaking through the fence. The mood, however, was different. The head of Hamas's political bureau is seen celebrating the operation, carried out not only by Hamas fighters, but by all the resistance fighters in the Gaza Strip. Such was the case at the Jenin refugee camp. Israel has declared a state of war alert, striking back, setting the stage for a new heavy war. Hamas fighters are seen inside an Israeli military camp, which shows the shock surprise of Israeli army. Here, Hamas fighters are seen with a captured Israeli military vehicle. This is a large operation including all Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank, namely Hamas, PFLP, the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigades, and the Islamic Jihad movement. In the occupied West Bank, the Lion's Den is also active. Israeli towns are on fire, like Rehovot in southern Israel, and Ashkelon seen burning after resistance rockets landed there. So dire the situation, Israelis were forced to hide in trash bins. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are looking for cover, while sounding defiant when it comes to Israeli regime forces. Israel is finding itself on shaky grounds, even though it has mobilized reservists. There are shortages since reservists, along with pilots, have refused to take orders due to its so-called judicial reforms, which is why this announcement by Netanyahu may fall on deaf ears. Our enemy will pay a price, the type of which it has never known. That was a statement from Netanyahu. The surprise offensive that Palestinian fighters executed against the Israeli regime is a natural outcome of what Israel has done with Palestinians over the decades. Hezbollah summed it up best. This was a decisive response to Israel's continued occupation. However, Hezbollah also added this to its statement. This is a message to those seeking normalization with Israel. A clear reference to Saudi Arabia, which is said to be in talks with Israel for, quote, normalization. Ever since this extreme cabinet came into power, it has violated Palestinians on a daily basis. Not that previous Israeli officials did not do that, but this cabinet has done it at warp speed, which puts into question why Saudi Arabia would be interested in pursuing a, quote, normalization. Any normalization with Israel would be a stab in the back of Palestinians. Just the other day, Israel announced that it will legitimize the killing of Palestinian citizens in new open-fire rules. It said the new measure seeks to allow officers to use live fire against Palestinian protesters. Al-Aqsa violations, Israeli incursions, injuring and killing Palestinians. All of this in the face of the silence by the international community. How much longer could Palestinians endure this?
The war drags on in Ukraine, signs are emerging that do not bode well for the US-led coalition against Russia. Just days ago, the Slovak Social Democracy Party, which is a pro-Russia party, won the country's parliamentary elections. The leftist Smeristy Party, led by former Premier Robert Fico, has not secured enough votes to form a government and needs to form a coalition with other parties. But the victory has been interpreted as a sign of growing war fatigue in Europe. The party's leader has said that no more weapons would go to Ukraine. He has also questioned the logic of the EU's Russia sanctions and even accused NATO of causing the war.
I believe that on the one hand, yes, we should expect certain, let's say, uncomfortable relationship between Brussels and Slovakia. But then on the other hand, I also think that the relationship will also be rather pragmatic. However, the danger is real when it comes to Slovakia's declining support to Ukraine. And this will also have its impact to weaken the EU's unity when it comes to its support for Ukraine.
Just weeks ago, Poland, a staunch ally of Ukraine, announced that it would no longer supply weapons to its neighbor amid a diplomatic dispute over Kiev's grain exports. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki has said that Poland's focus was instead on defending itself with more modern weapons. The country's president later tried to modify this stance, but the dispute is seen as a rift among members of the anti-Moscow alliance. Poland has supplied hundreds of Soviet-era tanks and 14 MiG-29 fighter jets to Ukraine and served as a major transit hub for weapons from other Western nations. These developments have stirred talk of a global shift in sentiment towards supporting Ukraine as the war grinds on, more than a year and a half after it began.
It is full of Ukrainians here. This is what I seriously do not like. They get benefits, energy costs went up, everything went up. So basically, they are getting benefits, and we, our citizens, we pay.
The money spent on the war in Ukraine has unnerved many citizens in European countries. Days ago, hundreds of people staged rallies in different German cities to vent their anger at Berlin's growing support for Ukraine. Many protesters carried banners and placards advocating for peace in Ukraine while expressing opposition to government policies, including the remilitarization of Germany. Demonstrators said Germany's decision to send more weaponry to Ukraine risks escalation of the conflict with Russia. Some protesters demanded that Germany pull out from the NATO alliance. Some said the United States is benefiting from Germany's intervention in the Russia-Ukraine war. Germany is among Western countries that have provided Ukraine with a wide range of weapons since the war erupted in February 2022.
I'm mainly concerned with crisis intervention and resolving this armed conflict on the one hand. On the other hand, of course, there are trends in the militarization of Germany. After all, from a purely political point of view, Germany is right in the middle, and America is shamelessly taking advantage of that too, using citizens through media policy to perhaps ultimately use them for their own goals, and Ukrainian citizens were also exploited.
The German economy has suffered due to crisis in Ukraine. It tipped into a recession at the start of the year and stagnated in the second quarter. High inflation, industrial slowdown, and reduction in global demand for manufactured goods have all been weighing on the German economy. And earlier in October, dozens of anti-war activists in New York City said that the interest of NATO depends on the perpetuation of imperial capital and extraction of wealth from the dispossessed.
Unification of peace forces in the United States, recognizing that it's the United States and NATO who are are to blame and the fundamental cause of the conflict in Ukraine, and that if we can force the U.S. government to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine, the war will end the very next day.
A poll conducted in August said most Americans oppose Congress authorizing additional funding. Overall, 55% say the U.S. Congress should not authorize additional funding to support Ukraine versus 45% who say Congress should authorize such funding. And 51% say that the U.S. has already done enough to help Ukraine. The removal of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House of Representatives has added to the uncertainty around aid for Ukraine.
Kevin McCarthy has been ousted as Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives in a brutal, historic rebellion by far-right Republicans. The rebellious GOP lawmakers, furious at his cooperation with Democrats, have accused him of a string of broken promises. This is the first ouster of a Speaker in the House's 234-year history.
On this vote, the yeas are 216, the nays are 210. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table. The office of Speaker of the House of the United States House of Representatives is hereby declared vacant.
I mean, it's a sign, I think, if history is any guide at all to this, it's a sign of a party in disintegration. I mean, that's what's happening, and it's melting down, and that's pretty clear. That's the older history. The more recent history, I think, is that what we're seeing today is the latest installment in the, you know, ever continuing coup d'etat by Donald Trump. I mean, that's what we're seeing.
The vote to oust McCarthy marks a major escalation in tensions for a House GOP conference that has been mired in infighting, and it comes just days after McCarthy successfully engineered a last-minute bipartisan effort to avert a government shutdown.
I think probably the next step would be a shutdown, which is really what they're probably aiming for. They wanted to get McCarthy out of there in part because he stood in the way of that. Bunch of reasons, but that's part of it. And it's the politics of chaos.
The effort to oust the Speaker was led by GOP Republican Matt Gaetz. There is also a significant amount of distrust and anger from House Democrats towards McCarthy over his actions as Speaker and the House GOP agenda.
the rebellious lawmakers accused McCarthy of a flip-flop, saying he had promised an end to hastily prepared stopgap legislation hammered out with the support of the opposition and a return to budgeting through the committee process. Some Republican leaders condemned McCarthy's removal, with former Vice President and current presidential candidate Mike Pence suggesting it would undermine the GOP in the eyes of voters. There is no clear successor to oversee the House Republican majority. Congress has just over 40 days to agree on a deal to avoid another potential government shutdown.
But there is a certain nihilistic quality to what they're doing. However, there is also, you know, genius in the madness, because the madness is about creating as much chaos as possible. And then, you know, then the Trump people will step in.
Speaker Kevin McCarthy's ouster could signal a shift in the U.S. House of Representatives on aid to Ukraine, with some of his possible successors staunchly opposed to assisting Kiev. Republican opponents of the aid view it as excessive spending and a misplaced U.S. policy priority.
I rise to put the leadership of the House, the Senate, and the President of the United States on notice. I will not consent to any expedited passage of any spending bill that provides any more American aid to Ukraine. It's as if no one has noticed that we have no extra money to send to Ukraine. Our deficit this year will exceed $1.5 trillion. Borrowing money from China to send it to Ukraine makes no sense. It's not as if we have some sort of rainy day fund sitting around, trillions of dollars in a pot of money, and we're just going to send that to Ukraine. We're going to borrow it. When we borrow it and create new money to pay for that borrowing, we create the inflation that is plaguing our economy.
McCarthy earlier this week denied accusations by Gates that he had cut a secret deal with Biden to allow the House to vote on Ukraine aid. McCarthy said then he wanted more information from the Biden administration. President Joe Biden asked Congress in July to approve another $24 billion related to Ukraine. Although the compromise struck in Congress dropped new fundings for Ukraine amid opposition from hardline Republicans, it remains unclear what might happen next. Biden and his Democratic Party say the U.S. has a duty to help Ukraine.
And why it's critically important for the United States and our allies that we keep our commitment. We can support Ukraine in the next tranche that we need, and there is another means by which we may be able to find funding for that, but I'm not going to get into that now.
However, the issue has become so politicized in Washington that the fate of vital military aid is now in jeopardy. The U.S. has approved four rounds of aid to Ukraine, totaling about $113 billion, with some of that money going towards replenishment of U.S. military equipment that was sent to the front lines.
Since the beginning of Russia's war in Ukraine, the American taxpayers provided Ukraine with $113 billion. Over the 583 days of war, between February 24, 2022 and the end of the month, that averages $6.8 billion per month, or $223 million per day. There's a lot of things that we need to fix in our country before we borrow money to try to perpetuate a war in another country.
There are also widespread concerns over corruption in Ukraine. The U.S. is increasingly urging Ukraine to do more to combat corruption. This is while Ukraine considers the direct budget support it gets from the U.S. and other foreign allies to be vital to keeping its economy afloat.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرضه.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, I convey all this to you, lest inordinate desires, temptations, and inducement should start influencing you, or adverse changes of times and circumstances should drag your name in the mire, or I should leave you like an untrained colt, because a young and fresh mind is like a virgin soil which allows things sown in it to grow verdantly and to bear luxuriantly. Then, I have made use of early opportunities to educate you and train you before your mind loses its freshness, before it gets hardened or warped, before you start facing life unprepared for the encounter, and before you are forced to use your decisions and discretions without gaining advantages of accumulated traditions, collected knowledge, and experiences of others. These words of advice and counsels that I give you will save you from the worry of acquiring knowledge, gathering experiences, and soliciting advice from others. Now, you can easily make use of all the knowledge which men have to acquire with great care, trouble, and patience. Things which were hidden from them, and which only experiments, experiences, and sufferings could bring to light, are now made easily available to you through these exhortations. My dear son, though the span of my life is not as that of some other people who have passed away before me, yet I took great care to study their lives. Assiduously, I went through their activities. I contemplated over their deliberations and deeds. I studied their remains, relics, and ruins. I pondered over their lives so deeply that I felt as if I have lived and worked with them from early ages of history down to our times, and I know what did them good and what brought them harm.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the beautiful things that we find in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this idea that His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam and the rightful successor to the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he never feared another human being, but he always feared the Almighty Allah. Now, this is one of the fundamental principles in Islam, and that is that we must fear the disobedience to the Almighty Allah at all times. But on the other hand, we must not fear another human being. And now, sure, we need to respect our parents. We need to respect the religious scholars. We need to respect one another. These things in its due place, but we shouldn't be fearful of them. We shouldn't think that they have complete power and control over us. The only being, if you will, that has complete power and control over us is the Almighty Allah. And so we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he didn't fear other human beings. And so we too must not fear other human beings, because that fear is in reality a sign of us being subservient to that human being. Yes, respect is a different thing, and it is wajib, it is obligatory to respect our parents. And of course, you know, it is necessary to respect the religious scholars and the religious leadership, and it is necessary to respect one another. But this respect is very different from fear. If we are to fear anyone, if we are to have reverential fear for anyone, if we are to fear disobeying somebody, or we are to fear dissatisfying somebody, then we must fear the Almighty Allah. We should avoid at all costs disobeying the Almighty Allah or incurring the wrath of the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? And so a principle in general that we should not fear other human beings, but matter of fact, we should have fear for and from the Almighty Allah. A very thought-provoking lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسی در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
کل صبح و کل شب ایام تبک عینی به دمع مشتاق ایام قد لسعت حیت الهوا کبدی فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
We are on two sides. Either you love Ali ibn Abi Talib or you hate Ali ibn Abi Talib. That's if you know Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that is why we find a hadith from our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. أنه قال لعليٍ يا علي لا يحبك إلا مؤمن ولا يبغضك إلا منافق. He says, oh Ali, no. That those who love you, that is a sign of iman. Yeah, and for those who hate you, that is a sign of nifaq, hypocrisy in their hearts. Now, we need to look, before we describe what is it about Imam Ali alayhi salam that makes him loved and hated at the same time so much, we need to have an introduction to understand this whole idea or this concept of this jazibiyah, as it is known in Arabic, this attraction. So now, when we think about this power of attraction and repulsion, people and human beings normally fall into one camp. So you're in one camp when it comes to this power of attraction and repulsion. The first camp is for those people who neither have repulsion nor do they have attraction. These are people who want to stay under the radar. They don't want to make waves. Yeah, they don't want to pick a side. Yeah, they say, I'll do whatever. They stay under the radar. Whether you are there, people don't know. Whether you are not there, people don't know. Nobody cares. Nobody likes them. Nobody hates them. These are people who think that this is the best way to live. And in fact, this is a very cowardly way to live. This is not the way we are told in Islam to live. In Islam, we are told to love, and in Islam, we are told to hate. A man comes up to our sixth imam, a man by the name of Fudail bin Yasar. He comes up to our sixth imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And he says, Ya Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, he says, Ya Ibn Rasulullah, anil hubbi wal bughd amin al-Iman? Is love and hatred part of faith or not? Yes? Or do I just become a very nice person? I don't love anybody, but hey, I don't hate anybody. Yeah? So I'm okay. He says, is it part of faith? The Imam alayhi salam replies, halil iman illa al-hubbi wal-bughd? Is faith anything else but love and hate? Yeah? Our entire concept of faith is based on love and hate, not who I love. Who I love absolutely has no bearing on it. Who I hate absolutely has no bearing on it. It is who Allah loves, I love. Who Allah hates, I hate. And this is supplied to us from the Holy Quran. The Imam continues and he says, ثُمَّ تَلَى هَذِهِ الْآيَةِ That means the Imam then recited this verse of the Quran. He says, حَبَّبَ إِلَيْكُمُ الْإِيمَانِ وَزَيَّنَهُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made beautiful for you iman and those who have iman, and he has made this something desirable for your heart. Therefore, when you see somebody who is on iman, you automatically love that person. But then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, wa karraha, he has made it detestable for you, something hated. Ilaykum al-kufru wal-fusuqu wal-isyan. He has made disbelief something naturally that you would hate in your heart.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.